This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, November 16th, 2004. The destruction is incredible. It's overwhelming, said Sergeant Todd Bowers, a Marine Civil Affairs specialist attached to the 3rd Battalion, 5th Marine Regiment. It's a city where the homes and businesses for 300,000 people are packed in an area a little less than 2 miles wide and a little more than that long. He's speaking of Fallujah, now a city of piles of shattered concrete blocks and bricks, downed power lines, toppled light poles, broken glass, twisted traffic barriers, walls and security gates laced with bullet holes, homes knocked down, shops knocked down, houses flattened, half of the mosques in ruins. Phone lines hanging, slack in rubble, human remains littering the empty streets. Fallujah, a sea of rubble and death, says Reuters. Fallujah, a swath of destruction, says Dexter Philbin of the New York Times. Fallujah, a sea of rubble and death, our Taking Aim program today. Ralph?
I don't think it's a matter of redundancy, Maya. I think it's essential that we look at the extraordinary description, even with the embedded press, of the devastation and the deliberate destruction. In fact, the targeting of the entire population of this city. Fallujah battered the Washington Post today. Even the dogs have started to die, their corpses strewn among twisted metal and shattered concrete. It is in a city that forgot to breathe. The aluminum shutters of shops on the main highway have been transformed into mangled accordion shapes. The sharp, jarring slices of metal that no longer obscure stacks of silver pots, plastic-wrapped furniture, rolls of carpet. This is a remnant of a population in the center of Fallujah.
A tableau of devastation, writes Ed Harris, Associated Press writer. The sickening odor of rotting flesh, a stench too powerful for a brisk breeze sweeping in from the sandy plain surrounding the city 40 miles west of Baghdad.
Here is the account by Dar Jamil on November 16th, today's date. The dogs are eating the bodies in the streets of Fallujah. It never fails to get my adrenaline flowing as the bombs detonate in central Fallujah and across the breadth of the city. The horrendous humanitarian disaster of Fallujah drags on. The U.S. military continues to refuse the entry of Iraqi Red Crescent convoys of relief supplies. They have the city in their hands, but they won't allow any aid to enter. The Red Crescent has appealed to the United Nations to intervene. No such luck. The military will not relent. And then, as we describe here in these accounts, the condition in Fallujah, consider the Independent of yesterday's date. The city lies in ruins, along with the lives of the wretched survivors. After 6 days of total destruction, U.S. warplanes, tanks, and mortars have left a shattered landscape of gutted buildings, crushed cars, and charred bodies wherever the eye can sight them. A drive through the city revealed a picture of utter destruction, with houses flattened, mosques in ruins, telegraph poles down, power and phone lines hanging slack, rubble and human remains littering the empty streets. The Jolan district, a ghost town, only the sound of rumbling tank tracks. The U.S. Marines point their assault rifles down abandoned streets, past Fallujah's amusement park totally deserted. Bloated and burnt bodies lay on the main streets adjacent to U.S. tanks. The stench of remains hangs heavy in the air, mixing with the dust. Bodies lay stretched out on the blocks ahead, heads blown off. Countless explosions which rent the city day and night for nearly a week. Bodies so mutilated it is impossible to tell if they were civilians or militants, male or female. Fallujah, regarded as a place with an independent streak, where citizens defied former leader Saddam Hussein, is lifeless. The minarets of the city's dozens of mosques are silent, no longer broadcasting the call to prayer that so often echoed across the rooftops. Weeks of saturation bombing have destroyed the city even before the soldier attacks began. The article continues. Fallujah is a city left in ruins, not just by the 6 days of the ground assault, but by the weeks of saturation bombing that preceded the attack. The article continues.
Ralph, in fact, the months of saturation bombing and low-fly and creating a state of siege, a biblical siege, such as you find in the Old Testament. It ought to go down in the history books, said Major General Richard Nantuski, the top Marine commander in Iraq, head of the 1st Marine Division. He is the man who created the onslaught, the assault against Fallujah. General Nantuski was speaking prior to the assault, but let's look what took place. According to Dexter Filkins, whose excellent articles in the New York Times describe the swaths of devastation and the onslaught, the harsh reality of the U.S. devastation of this Iraqi town. During the night, the insurgents fired off red and blue flares, writes Dexter Filkins on November 9th, but the Americans' night-sensitive night vision equipment were able to spot the insurgents. He says that the men started their invasion by firing a 200-yard cord containing 1,800 pounds of explosive southward into downtown Fallujah. When the charge exploded, it set off many explosions, devastating the entire path in front of it, creating rusty junk and creating devastated buildings, downing all the buildings. F-18s fired 3,000 rounds a minute in bursts. The AC-130 gunships droned overhead, their big cannons going thunk-thunk as they found target after target. Artillery would spit grenades and flatten buildings one after the other, day after day of this. And the PSYOPs trucks would go along with their putting out old AC/DC songs, something like a sonar ping, a cavalry charge to spur the Marines on their devastating path.
Well, the account in The Independent, which is continuous, by Michael Georgi and Kim Semgupta and a daily diary, virtually, of what has happened to Fallujah is evocative. Residents have been without electricity or water, abandoning their homes, congregating in streets under the shadow of destroyed buildings as the U.S. forces advance and target them from all sides. They'd cowered in buildings. People leaving the city describe rotting corpses piled up, thousands trapped, many of them wounded without access to food, water, or medical aid, and U.S. commanders refusing any access, any aid, any intrusion by the Red Crescent. Here is the Scottish Sunday Herald's diary. Inside Fallujah, a family's diary of terror. She weeps while telling the story. The tunic she wears cannot hide her shaking body as waves of grief roll through her life. I cannot get the images out of my mind. Her fetus blown out of her body. Muna Salim's sister Artika, 7 months pregnant when two rockets from U.S. warplanes struck the home. My sister Selma and I survived because we were staying at a neighbor's house that night. Khalid, one of the brothers killed in the attack, has left behind a wife and five young children. There are no fighters in our area, and the fighters are fellow civilians. When it began, there were full assaults from the air and tanks attacking the city. The houses have been razed by countless U.S. airstrikes where the stench of decaying bodies swirls around the city as the dry, dusty winds. The bombed houses collapse and cover the bodies. No one can get to them. People are too afraid even to drive a bulldozer. Even for people to walk out of their houses is impossible because the Marine snipers target anything that moves. The sisters, this account continues, described a nightmarish existence where food and medicine don't exist, and the thumping concussions of U.S. special bombs are the daily reality. Water cut off, electricity a rarity. They run from place to place, escaping the artillery and the air attacks. Even when the bombs are far away, everything falls and breaks. No one can sleep. Even at night, when it is much worse.
Ralph, as Agence France-Presse reported early on Tuesday, November 9th, the skies above Fallujah burned red as artillery, warplanes, and tanks pounded the city. Heavy gunfire ripped through the outskirts before the troops even ventured into Fallujah. While the warplanes pounded the center for several hours, black smoke plumed above the western fringe of Fallujah, and there was a curfew that had been imposed. Let's look at Nuntusky's plan, a plan that began in September when he was given responsibility for the combat phase. He was given the green light. Now, in April, as you recall, the Marines had a three-week assault on the city of Fallujah. Three-week offensive. It was called Operation Vigilant Resolve. While they had resolve, they were unable to defeat the insurgents, that is, the people of Fallujah, because you have to remember that this is also a war of words, the propaganda, insurgency, as if the people of Fallujah do not have a right to protect and defend their own city.
Well, Maya, Reuters accounts. The only good Mouge is a dead Mouge, said U.S. Marine Gunnery Sergeant Christopher Garza, using the slang term for Mujahideen that the Marines employ along with Haji as the Humvees drive past bloated and burnt bodies. The Jolan district, a ghost town after the assault, a shattered landscape of gutted buildings, crushed cars, and charred bodies.
Ralph, to create the free fire zone for the Marines and the training that they have been conducting day after day, year after year, for house-to-house counterinsurgency, just as the special forces had trained for years past, this is what Nuntusky planned, and this is what he carried out. The military appropriated six times as many troops and 20 types of aircraft than had been used in the April three-week offensive. They also faked attacks before the assault in order to, as they say, confuse the fighters. Maybe we learned from April, Nuntusky said in an interview with the Associated Press. We learned we can't do it in piecemeal. When we go in this time, we go all the way through. We had the green light, and we went all the way. Now, what they did first was to weaken Fallujah. They did this with bombing raids throughout September and October. They also dropped leaflets, which they hoped would demoralize the defenders and convince the residents of the city that they would be better off out of the city. And they cut off the water. They cut off electricity. They made Fallujah a place that was mostly inhabitable. In the days before the raids, the ground troops feinted invasions from the south and the east in order to have the insurgents, that is, the defenders of Fallujah, start shooting. And once they did start shooting, then the Army and the Marines would call in to the planes above, who would pound on Fallujah and on the spot, the pinpointed places with 500-pound and 2,000-pound bombs. And then they charged over the berms that had been built to defend the city. And house by house, street by street, six battalions of Army and Marine troops punched into the city on November 8th.
Yes, Maya, uninhabitable is the consequence. The city lies in ruins, along with the lives of the wretched survivors, once again the independent, bodies stretched out over blocks, heads blown off, countless explosions, bodies so mutilated they cannot be identified. And here, Reuters again, Fallujah residents desperate for food, water, and aid. Our situation is impossible, one resident contacted said. We don't have food or water. My seven children have severe diarrhea. My son was wounded by shrapnel last night and he's bleeding to death. I can't do anything for him. The accounts are replicated in every major newspaper, embedded or not. Coming through is the horror. This Guernica, this way, this Philippines of 1900, this consequence of American imperialism, wherever it extends its military and destructive reach. Here is an account in an MSNBC, U.S. probes shooting at Fallujah Mosque. The U.S. military is investigating the killing of a wounded and unarmed Iraqi inside a mosque. NBC's Kevin Seitz witnessed the incident while assigned to represent a pool of news organizations and reported the man was shot by a Marine who was unaware that he was there. The Iraqi was wounded and did not pose a threat. He was murdered in cold blood. This is not an isolated incident. It is, in fact, the standard procedure in which the Marines are instructed. When these innocent-looking kids reach the age of 16, said the Marine sergeant, they are prime. They are ready to be removed. They are to be eliminated.
Ralph, that leads me back to what I call the biblical siege, the destruction of all the men, of the Iraqi men, because part of the plan, Nantuski's plan, was to eliminate the women and children from the city, and many of them did leave. They say that they're probably, of the 300,000 people, there might have been 60,000 people remaining. That's still a lot of people remaining in the town. And these are people who had nowhere to go. You have to remember that people fleeing Fallujah over the last couple of months had to go into tents or were roaming throughout Iraq or went to other cities and towns where they might have relatives. The GIs force men fleeing Fallujah to return, reported the Associated Press on November 12th. Hundreds of men trying to flee the assault on Fallujah have been turned back by U.S. troops following orders to allow only women, children, and the elderly to leave. This is a war crime, according to U.S. attorneys who know international law. As it believes, many Fallujah's men are guerrilla fighters, writes the Associated Press. The U.S. troops have been instructed to turn back all males age 15 to 55. As you said, Ralph, anyone over the age of 16 is considered an insurgent, a rebel, a potential attacker of the U.S. Military. Quote, we assume they'll go home and just wait out the storm or find a place that's safe, one 1st Cavalry Division officer who declined to be named said. Army Colonel Michael Formica, who leads forces isolating Fallujah, admits the rules sound, quote, callous, but he insists it's the key to the mission's success. Yes, it's the key to the success, because the key to the U.S. Force, the U.S. devastation, is the genocidal destruction of the men of Iraq.
Again, The Observer, November 14th, you mentioned Major General Richard Natonsky preparing his troops. We're going in to raise the Iraqi flag above Fallujah, he shouts, eyeing the cameras and the eyes of the 1st Marine Division on him. Then he pauses. Two songs send a shiver up my spine. The Marine Hymn and the song by Toby Keith, We're Gonna Kick You Up the Ass. That's the American way. There may be some good people here, but we got nothing to do with them. I see the little kids in their cars. I may feel sorry for them, but when they turn 16, they are evil, and we will wipe them out. This again, echoing the Marine theme, these are soldiers, these are Marines, these are troops prepared for genocide. In fact, as the article continues, he describes Omar Hadid, who had his throat slit by a soldier. And then another Iraqi knelt blindfolded against the wall, waiting to be taken for interrogation by the ominously named exploitation teams, intelligence from prisoners extracted by terrible means, the article continues. In one house, Marines come across the bodies of Iraqi men. Their story will never be known. Fallujah is now in ruins. Every day, the Marines open up with mortars, grenade launchers, machine guns, and tank rounds, aiming to kill anyone they see.
Ralph, and that has been shown by the NBC photographer who was recording the pool footage, who captured on film the Marines shooting in cold blood the wounded Iraqi who had been in a mosque waiting to be evacuated. Now, we talked about the military refusing to let the men out of Fallujah. And this we have to point to over and over again, because even as people tried to flee, if you were male, you were forced back into the city for one reason and one reason only, and that is to be murdered. When a crowd of 225 people surged south out of Fallujah, towards the positions that were blocked by the Marine 2nd Reconnaissance Battalion, writes the Associated Press on November 12th, the Marines let 25 women and children pass, but separated the 200 military age men, that means anyone between the ages of 15 and 55, and forced them to walk back into Fallujah. There is nothing that distinguishes an insurgent from a civilian, the first cavalry officer said. If they're not carrying a weapon, you can't tell who's who. Well, that wasn't enough. In fact, last Wednesday and Thursday, American troops sunk boats that were being used to ferry people across the Euphrates River. And they not only did that, as we said, that they were targeting all men, the military officials say that all survivors, all Iraqi survivors between the ages of 15 and 55 will be tested for explosive residue, cataloged. They don't even use the word identified. They're saying they're going to catalog all the Iraqi men and check them against databases and then interrogate each and every one about their relations and ties. Ralph?
The series of articles in Al Jazeera, who had embedded reporters of their own, embedded because they were hiding from the U.S. soldiers who were going to remove them, Fallujah facing humanitarian crisis. It's a disaster. There's no other way to describe it. And if we don't do something, it is going to spread to other cities throughout Iraq, says this particular article. And the next day, Fallujah plunges into humanitarian crisis. The Iraqi Red Crescent, again, is prevented from entering the city. They are not allowed to bring any food, aid, or medication. U.S. forces have cordoned off the city and all its suburbs. They are conducting group killings and eliminations in Fallujah and its suburbs. The families are prevented from going anywhere. This is, again, citing Luai Mansour Abdel Karim, a Fallujah resident who fled his home and describes the daily event. The civilians are trapped. The ICRC spokesman Rana Sidati said, "We know what is their fate." Catastrophic conditions in Fallujah, again Al Jazeera. Conditions are totally disastrous. Our destination is Fallujah, but we know we are not allowed to enter. But those who we contact, those who escape, those who are able to describe, give a consistent account. Catastrophe. elimination of the population by design. The Al Jazeera article continues. Catastrophe in Fallujah. Again, the London Observer on November 14th. The full cost of the battle is only just emerging. Large numbers of wounded civilians left to die. This amid renewed warnings from aid groups that the civilian population faces a humanitarian catastrophe. The same language, the same accounts, the same particularity in every news account of what has occurred in Fallujah.
Ralph, we mentioned that the devastation that is occurring today was set up months ago. And October 16th, Dexter Filkins and Eric Schmidt reported in the New York Times, strikes against Fallujah intensify. Beginning Thursday, October 14th, U.S. jets began their most intense bombardment of the city, dropping 11 satellite-guided 500-pound bombs on houses and at what were called weapons depots, but in fact were mosques and houses. The Marines moved forward under artillery fire to set up checkpoints and to snare anyone who left the city. In other words, they cordoned off the city to try to prevent any men from leaving as early as October, and at the same time started intensive bombing. This, according to Filkins and Schmidt, was a campaign of U.S. pressure and intimidation of Fallujah. Low-flying F-16 fighters thundered through the sky all day, and American loudspeakers, as they were using now, began to broadcast warnings. And this went on, as I said, in October, but also it happened in August and September. So the bombardment was sending Iraqi families streaming out of Fallujah as early as 3 months ago. We learn one thing in Iraq. The blood causes more blood, said Razi al-Yawa, the Iraqi president and a Sunni Arab, when he was interviewed. What was taking place in Fallujah, he added, will send ripples as far as Mosul, which has the biggest Sunni Arab population of 3 million plus and is living in a tense situation. What the U.S. is doing is very dangerous. Ralph?
Again, the San Francisco Chronicle. Civilians are caught in a crossfire of artillery and air bombardment and snipers. Survivors gather in a hospital donated by the United Arab Emirates. Medical workers have no bandages or antiseptics. The Jolan and Escali neighborhoods are particularly hard hit. Over half of the houses have been demolished. Dead bodies are scattered everywhere in the streets and alleys of Jolan, Fallujah's oldest neighborhood. The blood and flesh are spattered on the walls of the houses and in the streets. Usually, we keep the gloves on, said Army Captain Eric Kvida of Gaithersburg, Maryland, the senior officer in charge of the 1st Infantry Division's Task Force 2-2. For this operation, we took the gloves off. Artillery fires white phosphorus that creates a screen of fire that cannot be extinguished with water. The population that is struck by white phosphorus is attacked with a substance that melts their skin. Kamal Hadithi, a physician at the regional hospital, said, "The corpses we received are burned and many are melted." These are the weaponry of choice. Again, white phosphorus, a colorless white or yellow waxy solid with a garlic-like odor that cannot be extinguished with water, but on the contrary, water accelerates its consumption of tissue and it continues to eat and consume right down to the bone. And here is an account by Islam Online with specific eyewitnesses, U.S. troops gassing Fallujah. U.S. troops are using chemical weapons and poison gas in the large-scale offensive on the Iraqi resistance, a grim reminder of Saddam Hussein's alleged gassing of Kurds. The U.S. occupation troops are gassing and confronting people with internationally banned chemical weapons, sources told Al-Quds Press on November 10th. The fatal weapons lead to the deaths of tens and hundreds of civilians. Their bodies litter the sidewalks. They use these chemical weapons with indiscriminate effect throughout the city.
You are listening to Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. We'll return after this station identification.
I'm a radio listener, more than a TV person, because I'm always on the go. The thing that kept me in contact with the world and with what's going on is the radio.
I've been away for so long, but I wonder.
And I listen to WBAI a lot.
The sound of the drums, it's
terrible. WBAI in New York City with Angelique Kidjo. Stay tuned.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener supported.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Today, our program, Fallujah, a Sea of Rubble and Death. Ralph had been describing white phosphorus, and it's something with which we're personally
more than familiar, having been in Beirut during the Israeli saturation bombing with white phosphorus when the hospitals were destroyed. And theological center was made into a makeshift hospital. We spent a lot of time with the young children and young girls who had been were covered with white phosphorus, their skin bubbling. It is an utterly harrowing thing to witness, and the suffering is beyond description.
And they didn't survive. In 1982, when the doctors, some of whom came from the United States, they had been emergency trauma physicians or from Indonesia, Sweden, Bangladesh, well, they had no idea. They had never seen white phosphorus, and they had no way of dealing with these burns. In fact, you can't, because white phosphorus only intensifies in its burning ability when you add water to it. I want to go back to the white phosphorus, Ralph, and an account that appeared in the North County Times. And this was from the April attack on Fallujah. The name of the article is Violence Subsides for Marines in Fallujah. But within this article, there's a harrowing account of what the Marines of the 2nd Battalion, 1st Regiment, who were based in Camp Pendleton in California, what they were doing in Fallujah with respect to white phosphorus. It's called Shake and Bake. And the description is of Lance Corporal Jonathan Milliken, 21, from Reno, Nevada, and a Marine, Alexander, who's from Wetumpka, Alabama, and what they were doing. "Gun up," Milliken yelled when they finished a few seconds later, and what they were finishing was their firefight. He grabbed a white phosphorus round from a nearby ammo can and held it over the tube. "Fire," Corporal Nicholas Bogart yelled as Milliken dropped it. The boom kicked dust around the pit as they ran through the drill again and again, sending a mixture of burning white phosphorus and high explosives they call shake and bake into a cluster of buildings. They say they have never seen what they've hit, nor do they talk about it as they dust off their breakfast and continue their hilarious routine of personal insults and name-calling as they prepare over and over their shake and bake. Every day, they fire rounds of shake and bake into the city. Like tourists at some macabre carnival, some bring cameras and other troops snap photos of their combat shots. Even the battalion surgeon fired a few of the shake and bake just for sport. "Everyone wants to get some," the troops explain, some joking that Fallujah is like a live fire range.
Hidden tragedies in helpless city. The Guardian on November 10th. "My son was hit with shrapnel in the stomach when our house was totaled at dawn. But we can't find a way to get treatment," said Mr. Abu, the teacher. "We buried him in the garden. It's just too dangerous to go out. We wouldn't survive." And that account is replicated. "It's incredible, the destruction," reports the San Francisco Chronicle. The accounts are consistent in every respect, in every neighborhood, in every street, in every house. Civilians trapped in Fallujah, reports the San Francisco Chronicle on November 10th and again on the 15th. Convoys of ambulances carrying relief supplies operated by the Iraqi Red Cross are stopped and banned from the city by U.S. military forces. Hospitals are destroyed, clinics have been leveled, and no aid and no medicine can get in. Here are voices from Fallujah from the BBC. The bodies are strewn in the streets. The families are forced to bury the dead in their gardens. There are lines of bodies as far as the eye can see. I am talking to you from the center of the city. We have no water, no electricity. We are going through our dwindling food supplies very quickly. No food is allowed to reach the city. Fallujah is closed off. There is no escape. We are all surrounded. We are human beings. This is an Iraqi city. Why are we obligated? Why are we subjected to this? I am just at a loss for words. The BBC account from Fadil Badrani. There are more dead bodies on the streets. The stench is overwhelming. A 13-year-old boy was killed right next to me. It is impossible to leave the house. We are cut off from the outside world. No electricity, no water. People are dying everywhere from their injuries. There is nowhere to go for treatment. The clinics that served as the last hospital was bombed and destroyed last night. Voices from Fallujah, from the BBC. Catastrophic conditions, reports the Independent on the 3rd. Fallujah is in a disastrous situation. Movement is impossible. The residents are targeted by snipers. The wounders cry for help, and they bleed to death. Assault on the mosques. Half the mosques of Fallujah have been destroyed. Warplanes launching continuous airstrikes. Fierce artillery bombardment. Journalist Fadl al-Badrani estimated that of 120 mosques in the city, half of the city's mosques have been destroyed after being targeted by U.S. air and tank strikes. In fact, 120 mosques are only in one quarter of the city because there are multiple more mosques. It was known as the City of Mosques.
Ralph, let's go back to the actual structure of the battle plan, because we were talking about the months of bombardment, the heavy bombardment of Fallujah, and creating a free fire zone is the way you described it. That's what they were trying to do, is to eliminate most of the population except for the men who they wanted to target, that is all Iraqi men. And the bombing itself is called by the military softening up the battle space. It's this total depersonalization, as I described, with the shake and bake and the Marines with their buddy excitement, as if they were watching a football game. And in fact, that's what they're doing when they're watching the football games, is preparing them for these battle scenarios. Go kick some butt. That's what the higher-ups, the military leaders, are telling them, go out and go kick some butt when they are talking about leveling a city and destroying the social infrastructure of a community, of a nation. So the first things they do is softening up the battle space with these heavy bombs, and then cutting off the water and the power, making life making the city
uninhabitable.
And then the first target of this battle, what was the first target? The first target was the Fallujah General Hospital, which is described by Rory McCarthy in The Guardian as a small, poorly equipped facility on the western outskirts of the city. And he says it should have been protected under the Geneva Conventions. And deemed by any legitimate U.S. commander as off-limits. But in fact, Fallujah General Hospital was the first target of what was originally called Operation Phantom Fury, but what they changed in this war of words to Operation Al-Fajr, Operation The Dawn, as if they were creating a new day for the Iraqi people. In fact, what they are creating is a day of mass rebellion for the Iraqi people. Now, Richard Opel Jr. in the New York Times described the offensive against the Fallujah General Hospital. And this is his report of November 8th. The assault against Fallujah began here Sunday night as American special forces and Iraqi troops burst into Fallujah General Hospital and seized it within an hour. Ear-splitting bangs rang out as troops used a gun-like tool called a doorbuster, which uses the force from firing a blank .22 caliber cartridge to thrust forward a chisel to break heavy door locks. Iraqi troops kicked the doors in, some not waiting for the locks to break. Patients and hospital employees were rushed out of the rooms by armed soldiers in order to sit or lie on the floor while troops tied their hands behind their backs. Now, why was the hospital considered the first target? It was for a basic reason. This meant that the wounded within Fallujah could not receive any treatment. And also, during the April offensive, it was the reports that came from the hospital of the casualties that went out and affected world opinion. So what the first thing that the U.S. forces decided they must do is to prevent any reporting, except that is controlled by the U.S. Army and the Marines, with the reporters who are embedded with those Marines. In other words, they are censored reports.
Maya, consider another dimension of this deliberate destruction and preparation for destruction of the city of Fallujah, because Fallujah is not alone. Here is an important study by the Cambridge Solidarity Organization with Iraq, consisting of scientists and of scholars. It's called CASI. Denial of water to Iraqi cities. Water supplies to Talafar, Samarra, and Fallujah were cut off during U.S. attacks over a period of 2 months, affecting 750,000 civilians. It is part of a deliberate U.S. policy of denying water to the residents of cities prepared for attack. It has been adopted without public debate and without any examination, a total breach of international law, and it is a feature. Evidence for the denial of water. Tal Afar, on September 19, 2004, the Washington Post reported that U.S. forces had, quote, cut off the water supplies to Tal Afar. The water shortage is terrible. It is Tal Afar is completely surrounded. Entries and exits are banned, and all water is cut off. Samarra, water and electricity were cut off during the assault on Samarra, according to the Knight Ridder newspaper in its report on October 1st. The Washington Post states explicitly the U.S. forces prepared for this. Al-Shakiwa, an Iraqi television station, reported that the teams were working to attempt to restore power and water supply because the sewage network is devastated now in Samarra. Fallujah, electricity and water cut off to the city, preparing for a fresh wave of strikes that began Thursday night, and again in other cases throughout Iraq. Najaf, Basra, water cut off in order to not just entrap the civilian population, but to weaken them and to set them up for the devastation to follow. John Pilger's article in the New Statesman is evocative. In Iraq, the unthinkable has become normal. Direct brutalizing and killing, work on improving technology, a better crematory gas, a longer burning and more adhesive napalm, fragments that penetrate the fresh flesh in hard-to-trace patterns. It is the function of experts and the mainstream media to normalize the unthinkable for the general public. And that account is evocative as well because of the description by a former staff sergeant of the Marine Corps, a 12-year Marine veteran, Jimmy Massey of Waynesville, North Carolina, a small town in the Smoky Mountains outside of Asheville. He entered Iraq as part of the U.S. invasion in March. He witnessed and participated in the killing of innocent civilians. During one period, over 30 civilians were murdered in cold blood. Massey, horrified, unable to reconcile himself to what was taking place across Iraq, began to speak out to his superiors. He was medevaced out of Iraq and diagnosed with depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, and then labeled as a conscientious objector. Massey grew up in the mountains of western North Carolina. His father was a truck driver, and Massey was still in his early teens when the mother moved to Texas, where she took a job with the Texas Board of Corrections. His disillusionment with the military began as a recruiter when he began to question the methods used by the Marines in preying on young people from economically depressed areas. On recruiting duty, I began to question, what are we doing here? I'm not going to say the Marine Corps is all flat-out lies, but we are setting up kids from poor neighborhoods, from the Appalachian Mountains, from the hoods, where they have no employment. You know, these kids are just thankful that we've got some health care for them. Why, the first time I could go to a dentist was when I joined the Marine Corps. And in boot camp, it's designed to dehumanize and desensitize. I was a Marine Corps boot camp instructor for 2.5 years. I know what we do. We strip you down, we rebuild you, and we condition people to destroy the population that they encounter and to look upon them as worthy of destruction. I'll be honest with you. When we are in the military, it's like being in a mafia family. You don't step outside. I mean, you're taken care of. And it's a condition in which conformity is obligatory. It is very hard to break away from. You have to reach down deep in your soul to question what you're being prepared to do. You have to look at what is the overall goal of your own life. We're a bunch of cowboys. We ride into town shooting up the place, and then there are charred bodies everywhere, people dead wherever you look. This isn't a matter of fighting. This is a matter of murder. As far as I'm concerned, we are murdering innocent civilians wherever we go. And that's our purpose, and that's our training, and that's what we do, and that's what I will not do anymore.
Ralph Massey has the healthy response, and he was able to have an honorable discharge from the Marines as a conscientious objector. But most of the soldiers are coming back psychologically wounded, as in Vietnam, where one out of three of the Vietnam War veterans had stress disorders, not diagnosed until many years later when it was too late. And now already 1 in 6, according to studies that have been done by the veterans associations, are coming back with stress disorders. And this is only the few that have been studied so far. They expect it will be as much as in Vietnam. I want to return, though, to the offensive. And Time Magazine, November 14th, and Sunday, November 14th, in its article, Into the Hot Zone, said, quote, the U.S. offensive has left much of Fallujah in ruins as airstrikes, artillery barrages, and ground fighting destroyed homes and damaged many of the city's mosques. It's impossible to count the number of enemies slain across Fallujah, and I want to intercede here that Dexter Filkins says that despite the U.S. Pentagon's report of 1,200 so-called insurgents murdered, when they went through the streets of Fallujah, they did not find the 1,200 dead bodies of the so-called insurgents. But the attrition of insurgent forces, continues Time magazine, in the city was decisive. In the long run, the rebels haven't been beaten. I want to quote, that's Time magazine saying, in the long run, meaning the Iraqi people have not been beaten. This battle of the United States forces, the Marines, with their heavy power, with their white phosphorus, with their planes and 500-pound, 2,000-pound bombs, was not a cakewalk. And you see this over and again in articles, not just the Americans who were killed, but you have to look at the number of wounded, over 400 injured soldiers flown to Ramstead, to Landstuhl, Germany, and where it says in The Guardian, the doctors were bracing for a further influx as the Fallujah battle culminates. Two aircraft carrying injured soldiers, when they arrived, brought in more soldiers than the hospital could accommodate. They were used to admitting 30 patients a day, and here they were having planes bringing 100 soldiers on each plane. Most of the patients had bullet wounds, although some had more injuries. We've had more cases of bullet wounds than usual, though some also suffered blast wounds from rocket-propelled grenades, said Lieutenant Colonel Richard Jordan, the physician at the hospital's deployed warrior center. Several soldiers needed intensive care with brain or spinal injuries or limb amputations, including at least 8 of yesterday's arrivals. Now, you have to remember that it's only the worst cases who were sent to Germany. Others are treated in Iraq. So the number of U.S. soldiers injured during this onslaught, during this atrocious genocidal battle, is yet to be seen.
Maya, the weaponry involved. Here is a Jane's defense account of what is the weaponry. The bomb types, the 2,000-pound Mark 84 JDAM, the workhorse of the U.S. military, with devastating effects. Everything with a radius of 300 yards is destroyed. And then the cluster bombs, the CBU-52B, the bomblet softball-sized shred and dismember human bodies. The dispenser holds 220 of the bomblets, and they are used against people. Then the CBU-68AB, used to butcher human bodies and destroy light-skinned military or civilian vehicles. The dispenser holds 650 baseball-sized bomblets dispersed indiscriminately over wide areas, razor-sharp slivers of steel, little BB-like projectiles that lacerate liver and kidneys and vital organs you can't, rendering the victim inoperable. The CBU-59B Rockeye II, the cluster bomb that is used throughout Iraq. The CBU-71B, similar to that, random destruction. These are cluster bombs that are used against the civilian population in particular. Then there is the cluster bomb, which is an incendiary device compared to a mini-nuke, the CBU-72 fuel air explosive. The bomb is made up of three separate bomblets dispensing an aerosol fuel cloud across the target area. As the fuel cloud descends to the ground, it is ignited by an embedded detonator, producing what the U.S. military calls an impressive explosion, which sucks out all the oxygen over large extended areas. This is an 11-page single-spaced account of the fiendish weaponry that is the standard means through which the entire population, and notably the children and the elderly, are targeted.
Ralph, let's not forget the tanks, the Bradleys with a 50-caliber machine gun, the long-range sniper rifles, and the new type of Humvee-mounted Gatling guns that soldiers say can fire 2,000 7.62-millimeter rounds per minute. And, of course, the overhead, the Cobra helicopter gunships and the jets that are dropping the bombs of which you speak.
Now, coated with depleted uranium, these artillery shells, these bullets, these bombs, depleted uranium. Depleted uranium, which is effectively a radioactive device like a mini-nuclear weapon, which is creating thalidomide-like deformities across Iraq and responsible for a large measure of Gulf War syndrome amongst the U.S. Cannon fodder soldiers in this brutal war of destruction and devastation.
Ralph, the U.S. military recognizes that Fallujah is a training ground, in fact, for their what they call counterinsurgency planning. In a way, it's like they're shock and awe. Level the city. They think they're sending a message, but the message that they're sending is not the one that is actually what they intended. But General Richard Myers, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said on NBC's Today Show Thursday, November 11th, if anyone thinks that Fallujah is going to be the end of insurgency in Iraq, that was never the objective, never our intention, and even never our hope. In fact, what they are doing now is going throughout Iraq. They do not have enough U.S. military in Iraq, 140,000 soldiers, are not enough to occupy and to control every single town. Fallujah is a city of 2 miles by 2 miles, a population of 300,000 that they had to send out of the city in order to gain even a modicum of control, and they admit that even today they do not control the city. They thought they had control in Mosul, but in Mosul they do not have control. They thought they had control in Samarra. In Samarra they do not have control. They do not even have control in Baghdad, the capital of Iraq.
And Maya, here's the piece in the New York Times, breaking a city in order to fix it. Fallujah is the little beginning. There is 60% unemployment. And in Samarra, the article tells us, crippling unemployment fuels insurgency in flashpoint city of Samarra. That is the Reuters report on November 14th, as you describe. Uprising sweeps the Sunni regions of Iraq. The accounts in the New York Times and the Washington Post. This is an insurgency across the entire country that grows and spreads with all of the devastation that is inflicted on its population. And here, the Australian youth and teachers are the dedicated insurgents. This is a war of liberation. It is a war of a population against a Nazi-like assault that has all the features of genocide. And what I want to ask is the nominal pretext for assailing Fallujah, why it is the ever-present evil of Musab al-Zarqawi, the al-Qaeda extremist. But here we have an Associated Press on March 4th, the Jordanian extremist accused of bloody suicide attacks in Iraq was killed some time ago in a U.S. bombing. A letter outlining plans for fomenting sectarian war have been described as a forgery. And that is not from one group, but 15 of the, not just the insurgent groups, but the movement and organizations of resistance have documented and have put out a declaration that leaflets distributed in the name of Zarqawi are in fact intelligence forgeries. Alleged leaflet by Iraqi militants, in fact, this is the San Francisco Chronicle, the alleged leaflet by Iraqi militant is forged. Al-Zarqawi is dead. Lee Keith, the Associated Press, on March 4th. The pretext, the demonized figure, it is all about providing a rationale for long-standing plans, the consequences of which we have described today, brothers and sisters. Here is Helen Thomas, and we'll end with this. Attack on Fallujah cannot be justified, she writes in the Hearst newspaper on November 12th, but she makes a very particular point. The justifications of President Bush and his hawkish circle have been totally supported by the Democratic Party and by the Democrats in both houses of Congress. The silence of the Democrats supports the president's hand, as was the case with the original congressional resolution authorizing war. The Democrats are fully behind the assault on Fallujah and the war in Iraq, concludes Helen Thomas. Yes, indeed. It is one ruling class, long conditioned to genocide, and that is the significance of what is happening in Fallujah, and that is the meaning of an ongoing movement to create a political expression of our own so that genocide is no longer unchallenged in the United States of America.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Fallujah, A Sea of Rubble and Death will be available on our website, www.takingaim.info. You can contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net or takingaim@wbai.org or telephone us at 707-552-9995. We'll be with you next week. Ni na ramatu de kenawo do wa, tikiti
I'm